Welcome to Middle Fingers Up, the show where we hold our heads high and our middle fingers higher. I'm your host, Kieran McKay. Today, we have the pleasure of welcoming Chris Strikes, an award-winning director whose creative journey is as inspiring as it is thought-provoking. Chris's artistic talents traces back to his roots in music videos, which I'm just so excited. This is the thing that I cannot wait to talk to Chris about. But there's more. Chris has produced and directed short narrative films, which have screened in festivals all over the world, including Cannes. His talent blossomed into something truly remarkable with his 2022 documentary, Patty vs. Patty, which captured the Canadian Screen Award for Best Short Doc. Most recently, Chris has embarked on a captivating endeavor as a co-director of a documentary for The Nature of Things on CBC titled Hairy Tales. This documentary is not just a mere examination of hair. If I may, it's a quirky and exciting odyssey, like kind of getting into the very essence of existence. And then there's all this exploring about what hair means to us and like why it matters, and how deeply intertwined it is with our identity, which I also cannot wait to get into with Chris. So pretty impressive so far. We're learning a lot of cool things. But the thing that caught my eye was a recent interview with CBC Docs where Chris shares his relationship with his own hair. This is something that I have been exploring and wondering and not really clear about why. So I stumbled upon his article. It hit me in many different ways. I reached out to Chris and 18 minutes later, he responded with, yeah, let's do this. So here we are. So welcome. Let's do this. Hi.
That's an incredible intro. Thank you for that, Kieran. And the fact that you remember it like 18 minutes exactly.
Well, because I also remember what followed, which was, well, prior to that was, and I told you before we started, like, I'm super anxious, I'm super nervous, because I'm really honored that you are here and we're going to talk today. So when I reached out to you of the possibility of maybe you may say yes, I had this whole like awkward word vomit of, I'm not an ambassador of selling anything. And because I was going back and reading this morning, and I was like, oh my gosh, I did say all these things. Like, you know, I'm not a bot. I'm just, you know, this lady doing this podcast over here. Will you talk to me? And so you said yes. So you're just as wild as I am then, if that's what we want to say, right? So thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for being here today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, okay. Well, let's get into it. So before I start, I shared some of your accomplishments. There are many that I didn't add. So anything that you want to highlight, that you want to throw in there that you'd like to share?
I mean, I think you pretty much covered it. I mean, there are definitely additional awards in there, but like, to me, that's not really all that important. I mean, it's very, you know, gracious and grateful to receive those things. But I think just overall, just, you know, being a creative and I'm pretty good in the kitchen, so maybe that as well too.
Oh, yes, okay. Do you have like a favorite dish that you make?
Not a specific dish, but I'm really good with stir fries. I'm really good with making a very flavorful stir fries, generally using a lot of West Indian and Caribbean spices. So,
yeah. That sounds exciting, but also like comes with a warning kind of a meal, right? Like lots of spices. Like that's the Indian way too. We always have to give a warning before we serve the meal.
Exactly.
This is not, you know, grocery store spice. This is... We don't know where this one comes from, so that's awesome. Well, okay, so I, you know, have my notes. I apologize for my thing. I asked you if, you know, I'm doing my job. I'm doing a really good job here. But I also want to know, like most interviews, I would imagine go right into the awards or those major accomplishments. You already know I'm a little different. We're going to start with, so I'm doing my research on you, learning a little bit about you, and I stumble upon the fact that your journey started with music videos and working with music videos. And I'm a like lover of music videos. I grew up with my siblings and I, and we still do this. I'm in my 40s. Every weekend, my brother comes over and we have new music videos to share. We don't care who's visiting in the room. It's like, you're also going to watch these music videos. I wanted to be a Much Music VJ, and everyone in my family makes fun of me. Like, that was my dream. So coming upon this, I'm like, oh my God, that's my favorite kind of video directing right there. So I just want to know, like, how did that start? How did you get into that path?
Yeah. So first of all, let me just say that you would have made a great Much Music VJ. I love your energy. I love your energy and I love your vibe. So yeah, let's bring back Much Music and let's get you on.
Let's bring Rick and George back and maybe even me. Who knows, sir? You know, yeah.
Right? Bring you on. Yeah. So how I got into it, you know, something that a lot of people don't know. So this is a little bit of an exclusive scoop for you, is that Cardinal Official, one of his uncles is my godfather because one of his uncles grew up with my mom in Jamaica. Oh. And so Cardi and I used to go to the same church back in the day. And when I decided that, you know, I want to explore that path of getting into music videos, I used to hit him up and like, cause he would only come to church every so often those times. Cause he was not that he doesn't love the Lord, but he was just obviously on the road, busy performing here, there, everywhere. So I remember, you know, I hit him up one time very nervously. I was like, I think 18 or 19 at the time. And I was like, hey, like, you know, can I come on your next music video set? Like, I just want to like learn and see how it's done and all that stuff. And then he's like, okay, rude boy, don't worry. I'll get you on. And then months went by. And then I'm like, yo, Cardi, like, what's going on? He's like, yeah, don't worry. We're going to make it happen. And then months go by again. I'm like, hi, Car. You know, because at that time I didn't know how long these things take to make. I thought, like, you know, it was going to be like a few weeks or at the most a couple of months, if anything. But so finally it came around that when he was shooting the Everyday Rude Boy video back in September, I remember this was the month of September. I want to say 06 maybe. He invited me out to that set. And it's an incredible video. Shout out, you know, director RT who directed that video. And I had, you know, speaking of Much Music, I had seen RT before from Much Music behind the scenes, making the video and like seen him when he was making videos, Point Blank, back in the day, a hip hop group from Regent Park, shout out Point Blank. And so it's seeing RT in real life. I was like, oh my gosh, that's RT. Like, you know what I mean? So like, I'm like, so I went up to RT and I was like, man, I've seen you on Much Music, man. I love your work. Mm. You know, you're from Calgary. RT is from Calgary, you know, so shout out Calgary and the Calgarians out there.
And so I
was like, you know, RT, like, you know, I'd love to intern for you, you know, be your assistant, like, you know, whatever you need. I'm not even trying to get paid or nothing like that. And then he was like, okay, cool. So he connected me to his executive producer at the time, a guy named John Natalin. Shout out John Natalin. We're still friends till today. And John Natalin, in charge of the NE, the Next Element production company at the time, he essentially would, you know, start reaching out to me like, hey, we got this music video coming up. Do you want to come out? And I was like, man, I'm down for everything. And so I was PAing and interning for basically about 6 to 8 months or so. And then I started getting paid. You know, I started saving up money from that. And then from like a part-time job that I was working, enough to buy a pretty good camera at the time, a Canon XL2, which is one of the kind of higher end prosumer cameras at the time. And there's just, you know, I during that time I was meeting, you know, up and coming rappers in Toronto and artists and whatnot. And so I was shooting, you know, street rap videos, you know, and that's how I started. You know, I connected with my buddy there, Aaron A and Eric Sim. Those are my two longtime filmmaking friends. Eric, I met on set PAing, and he introduced me to his buddy, Aaron A. And Aaron A was shooting a video for a rap in Toronto at the time. And then we all had great energy, and we just connected, and we just, you know, just kept shooting different types of videos because they came from kind of the skateboard culture. Particularly Aaron. So he was sort of used to bringing a skateboarding style, kind of like a Spike Jonze style, to his videos and whatnot back in those days. So those were really my beginnings. And, you know, things just kind of snowballed from there as I was making horrible music videos into decent music videos into better music videos. So
that's how it works.
Yeah,
right?
So that was my that was my beginning. So, you know, shout out to Cardinal Official because he really opened that door for me to come on set. And then, you know, that continued on with John Natalin, as I mentioned, and RT, working with those guys, and Eric Sim and Aaron A, and you know, it kind of took off from there.
So that's an incredible story. When's the last time you thought of that? Like, where it all began? You've had like quite a year, I would imagine, quite a few years. So when you look back to where it all came from, what do you think about? What comes up for you?
You know what? I actually thought about that recently because Cardi just won an award. Oh my goodness, I'm forgetting the name of the award, but he just won an award. And my uncle, well, his uncle, my godfather, I call him uncle, he was sitting at the table beside him. And so when I saw him in the video, I was like, big up uncle such and such. I don't really want to put his name out there in case, but I was like, big up uncle such and such. And then Cardi responded, he's like, no, rude boys, family always, right? Aww. So I was having dinner with one of my homies, and I was telling him about that. And I was telling him, you know, that like, that's how I got into the industry was Cardinal Official was the person who really opened that doorway for me, that pathway for me by inviting me onto set. So I did think about that like quite recently. Yeah. And it's something that I always reflect upon, especially anytime that I see Cardi achieving greatness, as he's been achieving incredible greatness throughout his journey. Yeah, just every time I see Cardi winning, I just always think about, wow, that like that's the guy who opened up the door for me, who opened up the pathway for me. And I think that the same with RT. When I see RT winning, I think that the same when I see great things happening with people who helped me along the way. Once again, Aaron A, Eric Sim, even the guys from Maximus Entertainment, that Taj Critchlow and Director X, formerly known as Little X. Like, you know, those are people who helped me to formulate my path in the very early days. So every time I see them winning, I just always think back to like, man, back in those days, you know?
Yeah. And I think that's like so important to highlight that there's many ways, many platforms, many forms of artistic choices or what we want to say out there. And I've been hearing a lot lately, just while I started this podcast, there's so many people in the BIPOC community that are really helping open doors or opening doors together or creating some space together. And I just think it's a warm highlight about color or not, just the fact that becoming an artist, being an artist, staying an artist is not always an easy, fluid kind of a job. And when you have support like that with others that are maybe a little ahead, it's cool when they look back and hold that door open for you, because somebody did that for Cardinal as well. I would imagine that helped him get in. And not everyone remembers that though, right? And once you get in, you kind of don't look back. So it's really cool to hear stories about people that came from Canada or people that, you know, started from a place of nowhere, and we don't think about people's journey from the beginning. We meet them in the middle, or we think about their story when they get the awards and are doing their speeches. But all these famous and successful folks are coming from somewhere. So that's pretty cool. Do you have favorite music videos when you go back and you think about, like, that stand out for you, or you're like, that was a great one, I love that one?
Yeah, you know what, a lot of my favorite music videos there's generally a story attached to them, you know, so like the Everyday Rude Boy video, for example, right? Like, that's one of my favorite videos just because it was the first music video set that I've been on. But not only that, it's an incredible video. It's a beautiful video. It's the first time we've seen some cricket styles in the video, and, you know, the mandolin playing dominoes and things like that. So it really captured an authentic essence of Caribbean lifestyle and Caribbean lifestyle within Toronto, Caribbean diasporic lifestyle in Toronto. So that's a favorite video of mine. You know, thinking back to, like, I think one of my all-time favorite music videos that I come back to several times per year is Michael Jackson, They Don't Really Care About Us. The version that was shot in Brazil, because there's two versions of that video. There's the version he shot in a prison set, which most people don't know about that version.
Yeah.
But the one that he shot in Brazil, that video, I mean, it's not like a story driven video. It's not like super special effects or anything. And there are other videos that are much more, you know, much more acclaimed when it comes to, you know, having a narrative or having special effects or crazy outfits and styles and or choreography and whatnot. To me, that video was just, it was just so raw. It was so real. It was the first time that I actually saw what Brazil looked like outside of a context of football. And by football, I mean soccer. So it was the first time I saw what Brazil really looked like. And I was, for me, I was like, oh, Brazil looks just like Jamaica. Like, I want to go to this place. Like, you know what I mean? I want to go to this place where all this amazing football is coming from. So, and those visuals really, they just always really stand out to me. And, you know, there's a moment in the video where Michael Jackson's performing, and then there's this woman who she just kind of breaks away from the crowd because like all the crowd is like by the side, and then the police is kind of, you know, layering the crowd to give Michael the space to perform. And she just breaks away and just like she's captured in the moment, and she goes and jumps on Michael and like hugs him and whatever, and knocks him down. And then like you see Spike Lee directed the video, you see Spike Lee like run in and kind of help pick up Michael. And they kept that in the video. And I was like, that's my favorite moment in the video. And I always remember that moment in the video. I don't know. It's just the rawness of that. Yeah. It's the realness of that. It was really seeing, for me, that was like the first time that I got to see Brazilian culture, Afro-Brazilian culture. And I was really blown away by it. And it's to the point where the first time that I went to Brazil, or, well, the only time I've gone to Brazil, because they shot the video in Rio and they shot the video in Salvador. In Salvador, where they shot the video, I was very intentional to like, I was like, I want to go to that space. I want to go to that square where they shot the video. And even to this day, you know, back in 2014, when I went, they had like a life-size cutout of Michael Jackson showing like, you know, this is the balcony he was on, and this is where they shot the video and stuff like that. So, you know, that video just has like a really profound resonance for me. And usually those are my favorite music videos. It's just that like, for whatever reason, they just have a really profound resonance for me.
Yeah, that's really well said. And I hear a lot about just preserving those candid moments and living in the moment. And, you know, there's a lot of humbleness and genuineness that comes with that and being authentic. So it's really cool to hear you talk about just the roots and just, you know, starting from the ground, essentially, as opposed to all the glam and all that's great, too. There's lots of videos out there that, you know, when Britney came out and did her videos, those were great, which I love, too. But I hear what you're saying. And a lot of what I hear you're saying is what I feel you're bringing over from your music video learning to the other form of storytelling, which is some of the documentaries you're doing. And even with the nature of things, the hairy tales that your article came out about, would you say that you've brought some of those earlier learnings and experiences from music video days over to this other side of film?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, you know, with music videos, especially with shooting street music videos for different street rappers and stuff like that, you're kind of shooting it like a documentary. Yeah. A lot of it is run and gun because, like, you know, we don't have permits, right? We don't have permits. There are certain things in there that we're shooting some real authentic elements, you know, settings and people and whatnot, right? We're not in every video are you necessarily casting actors or models or stuff like that. Like, it's oftentimes it's, you know, these people's friends they grew up with, it's their brothers and sisters, it's their cousins, you know what I mean, it's their aunties, their uncles that are in the video. So really early I developed the awareness that, oh, like what we're actually doing is documentary style. It's just, you know, this is like music documentary essentially, but we're showing a particular neighborhood, we're showing a particular lifestyle, and we're showing it in as authentic of a way that we can portray it. So those skills just transferred very easily over to, you know, making documentary, let's call it actual documentary, that's not music video, right? So there definitely is a lot of crossover there and transferable skills where it made the transition quite seamless.
All right. Well, can we move to Hairy Tales for a second?
Absolutely.
Before we get into Hairy Tales, let's just like do a little hair myth or hair facts. I feel like I walked out of watching that documentary knowing so much of like what I thought I knew. But really, at the end of the day, I've been sharing all these facts with family members in the last few days, and they're like asking me follow-up questions. I'm like, I don't know. Just watch the documentary. This is what I got. It's so, so cool that you did this. This was, I started watching this alone, I just want to say, and my kids came in throughout and sat down and watched it with me and asked so many questions. And it was really interesting to hear them ask as well. So let's play a little game. So we learned some facts with Hairy Tails. So the whole thing about thick curly hair and thin straight hair. So which would be the strongest? Thick curly hair or thin straight hair? Do you? I'm testing you whether you remember.
The strongest. Quiz time. Pop quiz.
Yeah.
The strongest would be thin straight hair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was very surprising to me, but it made sense when it was broken down to me. But when you just heard about it, when I just heard about it for the first time, I was like, whoa, really? Yeah. But that's very surprising.
I know. It's really cool for those that are listening. When you watch it, you'll learn, you'll meet a woman from Europe that was in the Guinness Book of Records for having the strongest hair, and you'll learn about her story. And it's quite interesting, and you see it facts like how strong her hair is. And then there's this whole like cooling down. So if you have thick curly hair versus like thin straight hair, you know, there's a difference in how you'd cool your scalp down. So do you remember that one, which one it was?
Yeah, so with thermal regulation of different hair types, straight hair retains more heat than curly hair. Curly hair releases heat. And that's because generally people with curly hair came from hotter parts of the world. So, you know, the body needed a mechanism to release heat through the hair, right? So with curly hair, with the dynamics of curly hair, it doesn't keep the heat trapped in and it releases the heat back essentially into the atmosphere. Straight hair does the opposite because straight hair people generally come from colder parts of the world, so the body needed a mechanism to keep the body as warm as possible, to hang on to as much warmth as possible. Yeah. And so with the dynamics of straight hair, it helps to preserve heat on the scalp. And that was those two facts were really, really interesting for me in learning from Dr. Tina Lasisi.
Who's so cool, by the way. I loved her. Yeah. She talks and explains things. I'm like, if you could have taught me all through my childhood, I would have probably learned way more in school.
Right.
Just the work that she's, because she's also biracial, right? So she comes from different parts of the world. And I would imagine the hair makeup, it's like complete opposites coming together essentially. Yeah.
Exactly. So where she can probably look at one parent and be like, oh, you have this type of hair, and look at the other parent and be like, you have the complete opposite kind of hair. So and then with her own, like, you know, she has that mix. And like, you know, Tina's really fascinating in that she decided to pursue this study and pursue this research because of her own makeup, right? And because like she didn't see any research that applied to her, right? Mm-hmm. So it's really incredible that, you know, she was driven to pursue that research.
Totally. And I, you know, like I think, you know, because we're talking about she's biracial. And then for me, I just feel, and I think we're probably going to go into your article here, but I don't know what it is about this thing with this fascination of the fascination that I have with the hair right now. But, you know, I can appreciate where Dr. Tina was coming from, because I'm South Asian. Both my parents are Punjabi. Both were born in India, but they both immigrated here young, and then they had us here. And so it's like my hair is like, well, you come from India, but you're here in Canada. And so we're going to make up this mix for you. And so it's, sometimes you're like, is this the hair that my mom has? Is this the same hair? And so my sister and I, you know, you grow up with, and I believe one of the hosts on the show, I think her name was it, Sarah? Was it?
Sarika.
Sarika, right? Yeah.
Sarika.
Dr. David Suzuki's daughter, which I also learned about. Yes. She talked about this in a really cool way too, because her dad has really curly hair. She has really thick curly hair. And, you know, you grow up trying to do the opposite with straightening. You kind of talked about this in your article too, like just trying to make sense of your hair. And some of it is also the Western and the Eastern clash, I feel, at times, where, I don't know, child of immigrant parents building bridges constantly about this gap that we sort of face. And so for you, when we go to your CBC Docs interview about your hair and the last time you cut your hair 13 years ago, how did you decide with your own journey with your hair and then this opportunity for this documentary coming up? Like, how did they fall in for you in place, or was this something that you initiated? How did we get to Hairy Tales?
And that's a really good, great question. So Hairy Tales is the brainchild of Leora Eisen, who is the producer, writer, and she's actually the lead director on it. I came on to co-direct, and I came on because CBC was looking to, and specifically the nature of things stream, they're looking to diversify the voices and to have younger voices come on and learn how to do a nature of things with the hopes of being able to do nature of things documentaries in the future, because historically it's a stream that's been dominated by white filmmakers, particularly male, but also some female as well too. And then as well too, documentary filmmakers that tend to be older or more seasoned in their career. And so they're looking to bridge the gap, especially because when you have your new hosts, Anthony Morgan and Sirika Kulisuzuki, they want to bring young filmmakers to sort of match that. So that's how I was presented the opportunity to come on board as essentially a mentee and a co-director. And in terms of the article, I think that just sort of came up organically in conversation, if I remember correctly, just with Leora. And she was just amazed that, because, you know, like we met each other for the first time, she asked me about my hair and whatnot, because it's very fitting for what we're trying to make. And so I was telling her sort of the story of my hair journey. And, you know, she mentioned that, you know, that can potentially be a great side piece to go with the film, because usually when you're delivering a film, usually there's like side pieces that you're delivering, like articles or digital content and these types of things. And so she suggested, like, you know, would you be interested in writing a story about what you basically told me? And I was like, sure, that would be great. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of how the opportunity came about, both to be a part of that film and then as well to share my hair journey. And as I was sharing it with the execs with CBC, like, you know, we went back and forth editing it and whatnot. And then I learned that it was going to be on the CBC main page, because there were things in the article that they learned about that they never knew of before. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm sure the same is true for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So I'm actually really glad that I got the opportunity to be able to write that article and to be able to expose a history and a new bit of information that many people weren't aware of.
Yeah. I honestly thank you for doing that article, because you're right. There's, you know, I encourage folks to go and check out this article. I'll link it as well when we post this episode. But the star of your article for me was your mom. And, can I ask you a couple questions about what you shared in the article?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So like when you're growing up, you're naturally, biologically, doesn't matter what race, where we come from, we developmentally 12 to 14 kind of start to figure out, who am I? Wait, apart from my parents, and we're searching for identity. And for some, it can be sooner and later, but that's usually about the time. And you set off at a young age, you're like 7 or 8 and trying to, you know, figure out what you want to do with your hair, and you wanted to grow your hair out. And mom gave you, you know, I would imagine, like I would say Indian mom, you would say Jamaican mom, like a hard no, which kind of you talk about answer that right away. Like, I don't know if you went back and fought that or not, but fast forward to a little bit older, you talk about this rebellious side of you, and you use that word. And, you know, I was thinking about that, and I think, okay, so for me, and I don't want to attach my connections to you, but as a child of immigrant parents and some of the ways that I've learned and been taught by my parents, a lot of those hard no's that I remember getting were always connected to me trying to build my identity or learn the Western way or connect to something else. But a lot of us kept fighting those, you know, like we say rebellious, we say we stood up, and I don't know, sometimes it sounds so bad, but that rebellious mm-hmm. side of you, or that standing up side of you, I think was part of, I don't know, maybe bridging that gap between society that we live in and Western world and these Eastern, you know, beliefs in the way that we've been taught. And so can you talk a little bit about that rebellious part of you, like how you decided that you were going to grow your hair and it was linked to your identity, as you kind of talked about?
Yeah, like I think for me, you know, for me, it was just a really cool style. And I actually didn't understand any societal view on it at first when I was younger. And, you know, I was thinking about this the other day because I had to make a really quick stop in Toronto and back to my mom's house a couple of weeks ago. And I forgot that as a toddler, I actually had a big afro, because generally you don't cut baby's hair until probably about like 2, maybe 3 years old the first time. So I actually forgot that I had a big afro and I had braids when I was 2 years old, right? So that was a little bit part of it. And I wish I had put that into the article. But you know, for me, I just loved the look, right? It was just like, you know, my favorite male idols that I looked up to at the time, or that I thought, like, this person looks cool, that person looks cool. Like, most of them had long hair. And so I just, you know, I just gravitated to that naturally. I remember a Looney Tunes t-shirt where it had, like, Bugs Bunny and Tasmanian Devil. They recreated the Crisscross album cover, right? And you may remember that t-shirt from
like
the 90s.
Really, like a deep core memory. It's a coming out. Yes. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Right. And so I remember that t-shirt, after I bought it, I was like, oh, this is really cool. Like I love how Taz and how Bugs Bunny looks. And then, you know, expanding that further to like Crisscross and how their hair looks. So it was just something that, to me, like as a young kid, it just looked really cool, and it looked like kind of how I wanted to present myself in the world before knowing these terms of identity and presentation and whatnot. And then, you know, as I got older and I started learning more about like kind of what some of the issues were around it and whatnot, you know, those things didn't really deter me from it. And I don't know where the rebellion came from. I don't know if I was being intentionally rebellious per se. I think just a lot of times naturally when you're young you're rebellious, but it's just like that just looks cool to me, like mm-hmm. you know what I mean, that looks cool. And then, you know, you fast forward to early 2000s where everybody's growing their hair out now, so like you got guys like Ludacris coming onto the scene, and then man, like a bunch of different music artists at the time who had braided hair, like I'm remembering Omarion.
We had Bone Thugs come out too, and
Thugs, yeah. You had Lil Wayne, like early Lil Wayne as well too, right? So you had all these guys coming out. Allen Iverson, he was one of the major influences, right? Where Allen Iverson would be rocking his fro, and then all of a sudden you saw a bunch of other guys in the league start rocking his fro and then braids, and then you started seeing other guys in the league in the NBA have cornrows as well too, and then Carmelo Anthony kind of took it to another level as well too when he came into the league. Yeah. So it's just all these sort of male sort of role models and icons that were in pop culture at the time. The ones that I tend to gravitate to, most of them had long hair. And so for me, I'm just like, yeah, I want to have this afro and, you know, have braids and whatnot as well, too. So for me, it was just all about how the style looked. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, getting older now, like later in high school, like learning that, oh, okay, some of these looks are actually connected to movements, connected to the civil rights movements. And, you know, dreadlocks are connected to the Rastafari beliefs, but like learning more about that, like learning more about like kind of like what do Rastas really believe, and why is there stigma like amongst numerous Jamaicans at the time and previously about Rastas mm-hmm. and whatnot. Right. So for me, as I started learning more about those things and kind of learning more the history of those things, for me, I was like, no, we should be okay to wear our hair like this, like where the decision becomes down to a personal preference as opposed to trying to fit into societal norms. Yeah. And so I think just both consciously and subconsciously, it became a thing that just kind of ingrained into me where it's like, no, this is how I want to present in the world.
Yeah. I love that, because I think there's so many, anyone that's ever growing up fought hard for something. I think people, so many of us can relate to that on some different levels. And, you know, what resonates for me is a lot of the things that maybe my parents or my family would have those hard no's for would be things out of fear. And, you know, they're here for out of survival and they're just trying to set us up for a good life. And I think it's such a sign of thriving when we get to say we're fighting that back and trying to educate. And instead of hiding it, let's showcase it. Let's talk about it. Let's learn about it. Let's grow about, you know, from it. And I think, again, to me, that's like going from survival to thriving. And that's a really nice feeling to be able to go back. I know I've had conversations with my parents about things that, you know, like, does this make sense why I did those things and where I'm at now? Have you gone back and you and your mom talked about some of these things that, you know, where her stance was for her and where maybe you led her to?
You know, what's funny is, so I sent the article to my mom and she actually doesn't remember those moments. So she's like, I don't even remember.
She's moments, like, what are you talking about? Right? Yeah. I said no to you so many times. I didn't write it down.
Yeah. So she said that she didn't remember those moments and whatnot. So, but she found the article very amusing and she thought it was, she really enjoyed it and really enjoyed reading it. So there wasn't really much of a conversation to be had because she just didn't remember.
Totally. That's like, fair. You know. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's do our middle fingers up. Sometimes when I tell guests that we're going to do the middle fingers up segment, then they kind of wait for me to like put some music on or do some kind of cheesy thing, but I don't have anything like that. So just going to invite you to share something that's on your mind, something that you want to put your middle fingers up to.
Yeah. So do I do it visually?
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Watch this turn into a meme. But
I know. I'm like, secret. No, I'm not secretly. I won't even joke. I won't even joke about that.
But middle fingers up to the rising cost of living,
oh my gosh,
breathing and existing and like just even trying to have a roof over your head. Middle fingers, middle toes, everything up to that.
Yes.
Because this is ridiculous of like where we are in our society, where we are literally in a slave or an enslaved society where our pay for so many people in what's supposed to be, you know, first world society. And this is Canada, but this is also extending to many other quote unquote first world countries, where the average pay is significantly lower than the cost of living. And that's just math ain't mathing, right? And that's slavery at that point, right? That's legit slavery at that point, right? So yeah, that, I think that's like the most significant issue for so many people right now. And it's manifesting itself in so many different ways. And that is something that like needs to be figured out and needs to be figured out yesteryear, not yesterday, yesteryear.
Yeah. I would totally put mine aside and join you. Like my middle finger's up. You know, when you said it's manifesting in other ways, I think I was having a conversation with a loved one who's really ill. One of those long-term COVID kind of effects are happening right now. They're really ill. And they have a business. And I'm like, what are you doing going to work? Like, this is like going to work with the pneumonia, essentially. And it's like, you know, and it's like, well, I can't. And, you know, we all think, oh, yeah, I have a choice. You have a choice. But honestly, when it comes down to it, if whether you're living on a single income, whether you're living a dual income, you have kids, all sorts of these things, people's health is being impacted significantly. People's mental health is being impacted. People are working, single parents are working so many jobs right now. And what does that do for who's caretaking? And what kind of impact is that going to be on those kids? And where are those kids going to go belong to then? And you're right. It's like, it's a trickle effect. We're not talking about fancy vacations we can't take anymore. We're talking about you can't even afford to eat in the healthy way we're guilted to be eating, right? It's just, how do you afford all that for yourself and your kids and whatnot? So I hear you. I'm with you. I don't know whose job it is to fix that, but whoever you are, I'm sure you're listening today. So
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, just in terms of like who's taking care of our children type of thing, this is a little bit of a spinoff, but not really, because so now parents are having to work 2-3 jobs, maybe even 4 jobs, where previously it wasn't so common to have to work more than one job. And so now also too, the rules are different for how you raise your kids, where if there's kids just running around in the street, no adult supervision, somebody's alert goes off, a phone call gets made, and, you know, child services comes in and gets involved. And that's a whole thing, right? So even if parents are off working multiple jobs and working later, it's like, you can't even legally just have your children out in the street playing without supervision, as they were able to in previous generations, where it's like, yeah, like your parents might be working like overtime or might be working a second job, but you're on the street, you're playing, you know, you're getting fresh air, you're being active, these kind of things. So now you're forced to, not only does food cost more, housing cost more, but you're forced to pay for care. Whatever that looks like, you know, extracurricular activities, daycare, however old the child is, or depending on the age of the child, you're now forced to put more dollars into somebody else watching your child.
As
you now go somewhere else to make more money to pay for, you know, somebody to watch your child.
It's ridiculous. I agree. There's the whole collective versus individualistic kind of approach. And, you know, the collective was like the village where the neighbor would help out. You could ask the person living in your basement. And now I think, I mean, definitely if it was already happening, COVID taught a lot of people to just like shut your doors and mind your own business and stay away from everybody. So you don't even get to ask a neighbor to, can you just check in on my kid for a few hours or whatnot? Because you don't know if that neighbor's well enough or not. So it's like a lot of people are isolating. That's what's happening. And to be honest, the truth of it is a lot of parents have no choice, and they're still, you know, they know what could happen, but they're like, I still can't afford that childcare. You're going to have to hang out at home. And, you know, I grew up a latchkey kid and I was okay. But these days, you're right. There's so many different things about that too. I hear you. I don't know what the thing to do about it, but one thing that I am finding when I'm talking to even this loved one the other day or what, it's like, can we just make sure we can try to open the doors to conversation so that friends, family, folks have an opportunity to talk about, like, are you also having a hard time? Because it sometimes turns into that, you know, imposter syndrome, right? Of this is just me. I'm the only one that's sucking at this. Everyone else is doing fine. Social media sucks because everyone looks like they're doing fine all the time. So you think it's just you. And not to be like all about toxic masculinity, but it still exists. And sometimes I worry about traditional homes and husbands, because often men have a lot of the primary care they feel with attached to the whole making of money. And so I got to go to work, got to take care of my family. And I know a lot of families are not, you know, the traditional sense, but there are some in my circle that I know that are, I can see it on the dudes and saying like, can you guys talk? And even to my husband, like, can you talk to other dudes? You guys got to talk about this, because there's this weird pressure that's happening for them too around how do I provide when I don't know where those dollars are going? Like, what literally?
Exactly.
So you're right. There's a lot of trickle effects, and hopefully we can be aware of how it's impacting us. And
yeah. And I think you really hit the nail on the head about just like reaching out to community and reaching out to safe spaces for men, for women, or for males, for females, and everything in between. You know, these are hard times that we're in for so many people. And, you know, we thought the pandemic were hard times, but like this is different. I think the pandemic was, it was very concentrated, and it was something that, I don't know for everybody, but I think like for most people, it's like, okay, there's like going to be an end date to this eventually. Like it was like, we're going to get back to normal, right? Eventually the date keeps changing, keeps pushing back, but eventually we're going to get out of this. This we don't have that with, right? Yeah. Like this is, and it's so integrated in so many things that we do. And so, like, you know, just really leaning on people for for support, for community, for healing. Those are going to be some really important mm-hmm. things and really important elements and actions to be able to navigate through this very weird time that we're going through.
Yeah, I would agree. You know, like sometimes we just simplify it and we don't realize the impact, like you're saying, to our emotional well-being. But then we like have road rage or we flip someone off for not the right reasons like we do at MFU, but we flip someone off in traffic or, you know, we're driving so fast because we're trying to get from one task to the other without having major consequences. And, you know, in my previous job, I had a little bit of experience working alongside occupational health and safety. And it's so weird I'm bringing this up, but anytime we were doing a construction kind of job, occupational health and safety is there to assess and make sure people are not going to die and all those things. But a lot of what I learned through there was like these accidents that happened, they're preventable. And so these little, you know, flip-offs or accidents or rushing and hurting ourselves, all these things that are happening right now, they're connected to what you're saying with the lack of self-actualization. We can't even, you know, to basic needs, how can we get up there? And I think we don't look at that part of our well-being too, that this lack of financial support is impacting my well-being and it's coming out in these ways. You know, domestic violence, all these kinds of things happen, addictions, all these sorts of things happen when we're striving to meet our basic needs because we're trying to manage our stressors in ways that are not safe, I guess is what I'm saying. So like you said, that community and reaching out, talking to someone just so that we can, you know, I can't control what's going to happen with the cost of living, but maybe I can be in charge of how I'm managing myself and contributing out there.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That is, I guess, the first step that each of us can take. And you know, in speaking of a little bit of maybe a woo-woo kind of situation, you know, once people are operating from a better mental and emotional state, hopefully that can lead to some solutions, some tangible, lasting solutions to help reverse or help deal with these times of like great financial strain to so many people.
Yeah, well said. Okay, so if there's anything like that you thought I was going to ask you today or that you wanted to bring up about Harry Tales, maybe as well as about the article we talked about, anything that you'd like to share or go back to?
I mean, I would just encourage everybody to go check out Harry Tales, which is currently streaming on CBC Gem right now. And the previous films, Patty vs. Patty, which is also on CBC Gem. Becoming a Queen, my first feature-length documentary, which tells the story about the rise and legacy of Toronto Caribbean Carnival's 9-time winning Queen of the Bands, Joella Crichton. That's a film that is available on Apple TV and some other platforms. If people can go to callowgroveent.com, so that's spelled callowgrove, and then a second E, nt.com/films, and like you'll be able to see my work there. You'll be able to see my previous films there. So yeah, I would just encourage just people to support and check out those films and the article, the CBC mm-hmm. article as well too, that you mentioned you'll be linking. So yeah, that's pretty much it.
And I can link these as well when we put your episode out. And I agree, like go check these out. So I'm going to take this moment here to thank you for coming on and chatting with me. This quest to figure out where my hair fascination is coming from. I think you talked about it on many levels about self-identity, our roots. And I appreciate the way that you speak. I appreciate the work that you're doing, especially in, you know, supporting the BIPOC community, the marginalized communities. You're doing a fantastic job opening doors for lots of artists out there that are trying to get out there. There was one other thing that I think we should highlight because I think it's really cool, that involvement with Hot Docs Cross Currents Canada Fund and the Netflix Banff Diversity Voices Initiatives, just again, highlighting your commitment to diverse storytelling. So my question actually to you, if you want to talk about, do you want to highlight that? You want to share that? Anything about that?
I'll share about that and then maybe this can help to inform your question. So I was a participant in both those programs. So the Cross Current was a funding program where they provided funding to becoming a queen, actually. So I wasn't like a facilitator of that or a mentor of that. And then similarly with the Netflix Banff Diverse Voices, where I was a participant in that. There's no funding attached to it, but I was a participant in that where, you know, I was able to partake in virtual panels, workshops, discussions for the Banff Media Conference.
Yeah, my question was more around, like, how do you, being part of the BIPOC community, how do you navigate the responsibility of representing underrepresented voices in the film's work? Like, how do you, like, that's a lot of responsibility on your part as you're trying to figure it out, but you're also trying to highlight and support other folks. How do you manage that?
Yeah, you know, that's actually a really great question. And that is a pressure that oftentimes people from, you know, particular backgrounds do face, right? For me, I just naturally gravitate towards Caribbean stories, Caribbean diaspora, Caribbean homelands, African stories and African diasporic stories. I just naturally gravitate to it. So it doesn't really feel like a pressure per se.
Yeah,
it doesn't really feel like a pressure per se, because, like, so for example, I had a friend over the weekend that was, we were having a conversation about, you know, potentially doing, he and his people had an idea about doing a story around a very historical time in Trinidad, right? And so he was just kind of approaching me about, like, kind of how they would go on about doing that and just basically asking my advice for it. And I was like, you know, this is some things that you would have to figure out first to be able to do it and whatnot. But ultimately, however you tell this story, however you figure out to tell the story, this is an important story because not a lot of people know about this. And he had asked me if I knew about that historical event. And I just kind of want to just keep that on the low just now, because I know that, like, I don't know if anybody else is thinking about doing stories around it. But and I was like, you know, when I went to Trinidad, I didn't know about it until I went to Trinidad and people told me about this story. Mm-hmm. Right. And so the fact that you're thinking about you and your family, you're thinking about potentially telling this story, I think is very important to do. So, you know, if you guys do want to move forward, let's talk about how I can help to support you, how we can help make that happen. And that's just kind of how I feel about our stories, because there are just so many really profound, emotional, powerful stories from all different avenues that have not been explored yet. Like, Hollywood is in a cycle of recycling the same stories over and over again, but it's like you have all these different cultures of people all over the world, and you haven't even tapped into that, you know, you haven't even tapped into that well of
story. But let's do Mean Girls twice.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, let's do Fast and Furious like 9 or 10 times, right? I mean, it makes a lot of money. So
yeah,
like,
well, and that's what it is, right? That's yeah. exactly what it is. And that's, you know, that's the thing. I don't know how we can fight that or not, but folks like you, there's people that I'm learning and getting to interview, folks like you that are doing it, that, you know, an important cause or a personal connection, you know, lack of privilege, all these sorts of things play a part in saying, okay, it's time to share stories that need to be told. And I think from an educational purpose, that's a great way to learn about our ancestors and again, starting at the beginning of a story instead of the middle. So kudos to you and your team for doing what you're doing. It's a lot of inspiration. So I appreciate that.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Well, okay, let's get you out of here. So if you were going to give advice to anyone and everyone out there that wants to get into the creative world, maybe it's a hobby, maybe it's a risk they want to take, but for whatever reason, they're not doing it, what would that piece of advice be for those folks listening?
Yeah, I mean, just shoot. We're at a point right now where so many of our cell phone devices, the camera in them is way better than the camera that I started with, and way, way better than the types of cameras that, you know, people who came before me or even after me have started with. So I would say just get out there and shoot. Like, you know, just shoot. We see Steven Spielberg's story, The Fableman, where,
cute.
You know, he's just shooting family stuff and then high school projects. And then now he's Steven Spielberg.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's great advice. Just do it.
Yeah, just get out and shoot and practice and have fun with it. And yeah, just find interesting ways to tell interesting stories. And stories can be, every little thing can be an interesting story if you find a way to make it interesting. So like, don't think that your story is not interesting. It is. It's just more about the approach and how you make a story interesting, right? So just go out and do it. That would be my advice. And
just like,
and
you did, you were persistent with Cardinale there. Just keep getting out there, hey, when you started your career. So
exactly. And don't be afraid to don't be afraid to offer yourself to volunteer on stuff. And I know that kind of thing is very taboo in these days now, like people are not really doing unpaid internships like, you know, previous generations. It's not a big thing anymore. But like, offer yourself, because like, being in the environment to learn, that is your payment. We just had a whole conversation about the cost of living and whatnot. So, you know, totally understand that element of it, that, you know, we need to meet as best as we can those costs of living. But, you know, in like, learning stuff and taking time to learn and build relationships, that is investing in your future as well, too. Mm-hmm. So if you can figure out how to do that, if there's an opportunity that arises, but maybe there's no paycheck attached to it, figure out how you can add greater value than a paycheck to the opportunity.
Thank you for that. Okay, so thank you for coming on today and for spending some time with me, letting me learn about you. My nerves have definitely gone down. So if we're going to assess I was at the beginning and where I'm at now, I'm so much better. So thank you. And for everyone listening, these conversations are door openers. So if you'd like to open a door with us, if there's something you'd like to add to this conversation, you know where to find us. We'll have Chris's information up. Go check out his films. Go check out Hairy Tales with CBC's Nature of Things. Thank you again for being on.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Karen. Thank you.